polls have consistently shown that fracking is unpopular. When three anti-fracking activists were freed from jail, they were greeted with cheers. The public, argues the Guardian newspaper, were ahead of the government in realising that giving up on this industry makes sense. But my guest today, Natasha Engel, who recently resigned as the government's fracking czar, argues that an urge to do something about climate change will hustle politicians into making bad decisions, and almost certainly make things worse. If we look at past records, hasty policy has had us driving now discredited diesel cars. We're felling tropical forests to make space for palm oil to provide biofuel. We're burning renewable wood pellets that are significantly more carbon emitting than the coal they displaced. Now the government, in response to environmental pressure, has instituted a de facto ban on fracking. I'm Darren Grimes, digital manager at the IEA, and I'm absolutely delighted to have you on this week's podcast, Natasha. Now, I wonder, first of all, if you'd go back and explain your journey of when you were an MP, because you were originally quite sceptical, weren't you, of fracking, of shale gas extraction to begin with, but you've since changed your view. What was that process like?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it kind of goes way back before then. And one of the issues was always in a constituency that was ex-coal mining, so mm-hmm. kind of based on yeah. hydrocarbons. And since the pits closed sort of in the mid-80s, there was very, very little work. So one of the big campaigns always was to try and bring jobs into the mm-hmm. constituency, and good jobs into the constituency, because it was all agency work and making, you know, making sandwiches on the M1 at 4 o'clock in the morning. And actually, in these sort of rural areas, that's exactly where these sort of planning applications always go. So I was very used to having quite controversial planning applications, including a wind farm. I mean, it's planning that kind of gets people out onto the streets. Mm-hmm. And so it's always something that I've been really interested in. But when fracking arrived, I've never ever seen a response like I had to fracking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had literally women with young children coming to see me in constituency surgery and saying that their children were going to die from the toxic fumes, that the houses would collapse and, you know, everybody would die that way. Either way, it was always going to be absolutely disastrous and terrible and life-threatening. And I heard story after story after story where I thought, God, you know, maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe there is something uniquely dangerous about fracking. So because I didn't know very much about it, I decided that I'd go and have a look for myself. Mm-hmm. So, and that was when I ended up it was the Easter holidays, the Easter recess in 2017. Mm-hmm. And I went up to the Vale of Pickering, mm-hmm. which is where the Kirby Misbetton site is. Yeah. Just to see for myself, you know, there was a well there and I really just wanted to have a look at it and to talk to the engineers and everything. And, you know, the interesting thing was that just driving up there, and it's absolutely stunningly beautiful, the Vale yes, of Pickering, yeah. it's gorgeous. And it was a fabulously, you know, just sort of Yorkshire spring day. Mm. And just sort of driving around, admiring the landscape and sort of turning a corner and seeing in the distance this enormous rig. I mean, much, much bigger than anything that I'd expected. And kind of driving closer, I sort of saw, first of all, it was a massive site, much bigger than I had been led to believe. This, you know, full of garish yellow piping. It looked an absolute mess. Mm. When I drove up to the actual gates of the site, it turned out that it was Flamingo Land, which is a theme park in Yorkshire. Yeah. And, it was absolutely nothing to do with shale gas at all. And actually, it was quite difficult to find the site because the real gas site, where they're already kind of, there's something like, well, there's seven conventional gas wells on the site. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to find it unless you know exactly where it is, because it's hidden behind bushes and trees and all the yeah. rest of it. And that kind of really tells you everything you need to know about fracking, mm-hmm. which is it just isn't what it seems. Yes. And so when I went onto the site, I defy anybody to tell me what the difference is between a fracking well and a conventional well, because they're absolutely identical. Mm-hmm. And then talking to the engineers about water contamination and health risks and, you know, methane leakage, all these things. I mean, and in reality, these are not issues in the same way that they're not issues with a lot of other industries. And really, when you compare fracking, which is just a process, it, you know, the end product is natural gas. Mm-hmm. When you compare that as an industry with any kind of, you know, minerals extraction, there is no difference. It's no more or less dangerous. It's really, the argument is about whether we want to import the gas or whether we want to get it out from the ground beneath our feet.
But do you think some of your constituents that would come into your surgeries, do you think they're justifiable concerns? Because you do have to accept, don't you, that nearby communities will have to tolerate small earthquakes.
Well, on the small earthquakes, they aren't any different, again, from any other kind of industrial process. So, you know, especially if you live in London, I mean, you're really used to sort of having lorries and buses. And, you know, if you're walking over a tube line, I mean, those sort of earth movements are many, many, many times greater than anything you might feel from fracking. Mm-hmm. And those sort of earth tremors happen so far underground that, you know, there's really very little chance of feeling it, let alone it causing any kind of cosmetic damage. But I absolutely take your point. It is something that is amongst one of the many scare stories about fracking. And again, it's taken out of context from normal development. And it has become something that people have been told is unacceptable. You know, and we're back to the story of the woman who came to see me who mm-hmm. thought that her house was going to collapse. Well, there aren't very many examples of that around the world. And if there were examples like that around the world, we would really know about them.
There's been a lot in the press recently about achieving a net zero target by 2050. Do you think fracking is compatible with that goal, that aspiration?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it really depends on how you want to look at this. I think 2050 is a really ambitious target for net zero. And it's actually something that if we're serious about reaching it, then we need to look at everything. Mm-hmm. The amount of fossil fuels that we use, not just in the UK, but globally in the energy mix, is massive, mm. absolutely massive. The amount of renewables that we use in comparison, again, you know, in the UK, but also globally, is negligible. So, you know, we've got not quite up to, well, last year, if you look at the amount of wind that came from primary energy, so of all the energy that we used, wind made up, you know, only just more than 2%. So, I mean, we're nowhere near being able to use renewables to plug the gap that would be left by fossil fuels. So really, I think that the big holy grail has got to be decarbonising fossil fuels. If we realistically want to get to 2050 net zero globally, you know, we're talking about the UK, we know that China, India, mm-hmm. A lot of the developing countries are emitting far more than we are, and we want to help them to reduce their carbon emissions and hopefully kind of find ways of abolishing carbon emissions altogether. Well, the only way to do that is by decarbonising fossil fuels, and we can do that by doing carbon capture and storage. We can convert methane to hydrogen so that we don't have to rip out our entire sort of, you know, our heating network. Mm-hmm. And I think these are far more realistic. And if we can sort of achieve that holy grail, then actually fracking for gas, getting shale gas out from beneath our feet in the UK, rather than getting it from Qatar in enormous great stinking tankers, makes much more sense, because then you abolish the carbon footprint of importing gas.
You mentioned Qatar, we're going to come back to that, but doesn't imported gas have higher emissions? Because every major forecast, if you look at the Clear on Climate predictions, they say that we'll still be using gas past 2050, whether in methane form like now or after converting it to hydrogen. So is it your argument that it's much better to source this gas in the UK, where we've got those world-class environmental standards and rules, and we can create jobs and investments in constituencies like that you used to represent?
Yeah, exactly.
And especially in areas that did lose out after coal mining went.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the other thing. I think that not only does it kind of bring economic prosperity to those areas that are at the moment, you know, extremely deprived. If you look at Blackpool, which is right on the doorstep of the Preston New Road site in Lancashire, mm-hmm. Blackpool's got youth unemployment figures that that rival Greece's. I mean, it's terrible. They are crying out for jobs, and these sort of really good jobs, proper industry jobs, would be an absolute godsend. And therefore, I think we need to really look at it in a much, much wider context. And, you know, I take the point that people make about, you know, climate change is much more important. It is very important. But actually, we know that it's prosperity and it's that economic boost to areas like Blackpool, places like Lancashire, that really actually stimulate that kind of positive thinking and that sort of scientific discovery and innovation and technology. Those will be the things that will really lead us to serious, you know, carbon emissions reductions. It's not going to be kind of, you know, kids missing school on a Friday, walking around with placards saying we're all going to die in 12 years' time, panic, panic, declare a climate emergency. I mean, you know, that is not going to do it. Actually having some positive, constructive and achievable sort of methods of doing this, that will achieve net zero emissions.
You know, I've got Russia here in my stats. And I think, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but last year the Russian share of our imports leapt massively from 1% of our total share to something like 5%, which is about an increase of 1,000%. This is mad, unless my dodgy maths is entirely wrong. But isn't energy security an incredibly justifiable concern?
Yeah, and I think that's really my... one of my greatest fears, actually. And I think if you look at the amount of gas and oil, and this is oil and gas actually, but the amount of oil and gas that we're not getting out of the North Sea, so 50% of all our gas use is imported, and historically that gas has come from Norway and from Holland and through the European interconnectors. Now Norway is on that same kind of line as our UK continental shelf. That is depleting too. And Holland, that's the, you know, the one of the world's largest gas on onshore gas sites in Groningen, that's been closed down. So those sources of gas that are very safe, absolutely secure, are not going to be available to us anymore. And so what we are doing is we're increasing the amount of liquid natural gas that we can receive. Now, Qatar also, not only is it very far away, it isn't the most stable country in the world. And that whole region actually is also, as we know, very volatile. And so, yes, at the moment, we are increasing our imports from Russia. Now, the other bit that's really scary to me is that by January next year, so I mean we're talking very, very little time, the Russians are planning to finish their Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
Yes.
And at that point, we will have Russia through Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 having the capacity to let about 70 to 80% of all the gas that's used on the European continent come from Russia. And we won't be buying it from Russia, we'll be buying it from Germany, because that's where they're sending the gas to. Now that, in terms of energy security, if we're that dependent on Russian gas, and this is Gazprom gas, that I'd really, really worry about. And I think that most normal UK householders, if they knew that that's the sort of dimensions of Russian gas that we're talking about, I think they'd worry too.
Yeah, suddenly a 0.5 doesn't seem as scary as the Russian bear on your door.
Exactly.
You are genuinely hearing arguments made saying that we will all die in a ball of flames if fracking or what have you is allowed to go ahead.
Yeah.
When actually, you know, the evidence doesn't say that at all. You know, almost all of the seismic activity from fracking was on such a small scale that only geoscientists would be able to detect it. That's from Durham University.
Yeah,
you know, the scare stories are... But why do you think it is just so intense? You know, the sort of level, the amount of sort of anti-fracking activism, or rather the noise that comes from it.
I think if you look at it globally, the environmental movement has really done a fantastic job in the UK mobilising against fracking. I think the word doesn't help, or it helps them to kind of make it sound like it's something uniquely awful and uniquely dangerous. But I think really, when you talk to people and you say, well, it's like any other form of extraction, and it's certainly exactly like we have been extracting gas out of the ground since the Second World War. There's nothing new about it. There's nothing different about it. This is about whether we get our gas from under the ground here or whether we import our gas. That's the only difference that there is. But, you know, having said that, I think that there is this sort of global environmental movement. And I think it's good that they have moved climate change to the top of the agenda. I think that's something that really does need to be dealt with. And it hasn't been dealt with. And I don't think people have sort of really addressed it. But having said that, that's not what this is about. Mm-hmm. And so really, you know, with Extinction Rebellion and mm-hmm. anti-fracking, and I mean, you can go into, you know, building on Green Belt, you know, all of these sort of environmental campaigns, and, you know, you can add GMO and, glyphosate, mm-hmm. Roundup, all of those. These are all kind of, and Save the Bees. These are all pretty successful environmental campaigns. But they don't really do what they say they want to do, which is to deal with climate change. Because if you close down the debate, if you actually don't have facts in the debate, if you're just sort of trying to scare people, they're not going to make rational decisions. They're not going to have that kind of positive attitude that we need. That is a, right, okay, this is real, what are we going to do about it? And you need to be positive, and you need to kind of inspire that next generation not to think that they're going to die in 12 mm-hmm. years' time, but actually to, you know, stay at school, learn, become scientists, go to university, you know, find the answers. And actually, I just think it's been, you know, it's been coming since the 70s. This movement has been building since the 70s, and they have been learning since the 70s. You know, it was Aldermaston, it was Greenham Common, it was mm-hmm. Occupy, mm-hmm. it was, you know, and now it's Extinction Rebellion. And I think, you know, with every single generation, the environmental movement has grown, it's learned, it knows how to organise, it knows how to mobilise. And what I find absolutely remarkable is how they can make 10 people locally sound like they are the majority in a constituency of 72,000 people. And that's remarkable.
Yeah.
That's absolutely remarkable. But I think it's really our failure to sort of understand that this is a political campaign, and we've been trying to sort of combat this campaign with facts, with policy, with reason, with rational argument, when really this is about emotion. And it's really now it's about whose side you're on. So are you on the side of the bees? Or are you on the side of, you know, multinational industrialists? Well, you know, everyone knows what side they're on.
Yeah.
In that kind of argument. But that is a really false kind of distinction
yes.
to make,
yeah.
especially if you want to deal with climate change.
So do you think then there's been a collective failure across the political spectrum to stand up and actually challenge people on the facts, the evidence, or even to just get to know the facts and the evidence?
Definitely. And I think also, I do feel, having been a politician myself, I do feel sorry for politicians, because the demands on you are enormous. I mean, they're from every single local issue, from potholes to street lamps to, you know, pruning trees properly, right up to national taxation, the NHS, police service. You know, I mean, it's absolutely everything. You cannot expect one person to be in detail on top of every single issue that bothers every single person.
Mm-hmm.
And energy and climate change has kind of really been the victim of that. And so really politicians look at, you know, where do I think that the general population is at?
Mm-hmm.
And whose side am I on? And it's about choosing a side rather than actually looking at the issues in detail, because most people haven't got time to do that. And you've got that against the backdrop of having a hung parliament and Brexit. So really that sort of rational debate that we need, it's just not possible at the moment. And so, you know, back to the point, this is about organising a campaign that gets politicians to understand and hear the arguments in the same way that they're being made by the environmental movement, which is simple sort of messages, simple facts, and putting them into a narrative that's interesting. To be honest, I mean, I don't know how much time you spend talking to your friends about energy, but all my friends just go to sleep as soon as I mention
yeah.
the word. So, you know, we've got to make it more interesting, and we've got to make it relevant to people's lives.
So I wonder if to finish, you could, I guess, say what you would most like to see from the debate, the current debate, going forward. You know, that we'll have a new Prime Minister soon. You know, if you were invited back into number 10, would you, what would be your advice to them?
I mean, I think what my main piece of advice is that climate change doesn't exist in isolation. It doesn't exist in isolation in the UK from the rest of the world, but it also doesn't exist in isolation from wider economic policy. And really, that the choices that we make are choices that we cannot impose on people, and we've got to take people with us. At some point, we've got to go back to the electorate and say, what do you think? Do you think we should all rip out our gas boilers and just, you know, go to bed cold at night and not run hot baths, or be able to cook on gas stoves? Or do you think actually we should be exploring some, you know, some more positive and actually scientific sort of solutions to this, like carbon capture, usage and storage? Mm-hmm. But really, I just think it's that interconnectedness that I think is really lacking. And at the moment, climate change policy is all about being on the right side. Mm. And, you know, so this net zero by 2050, net zero carbon emissions by 2050, it's not really something that people think what that means in practice when they say it. And somehow, you know, that there's been that massive disconnect between what we're pledging to do and whether that's actually possible. And I think we need to just make that link again, because people aren't stupid. And if you say to them, look, you know, here are the enormous number of options. One of them is never flying again, never using a diesel or petrol car again, walking everywhere, reducing your, actually, not just living standards, but your life expectancy quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. For some people, that's acceptable. For others, it certainly isn't. And it is more, it's more than just about doing your bit and recycling and having a bag for life and not using single-use plastics. The answers are going to be much, much bigger, but those have to be driven by economic welfare and prosperity, and actually sort of, you know, industrialization actually has the answers. It's not the problem. And that's the message that I would give to the new Prime Minister.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what do you at home think? Is fracking a sensible way to accelerate the reduction in CO2, or an outdated idea that should just be put out of its misery? Let us know at IEA London, and you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts.